From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this half hour was made 101 years ago, 1913 in Rochester. A big, beautiful station was being designed at the time, opened about 100 years ago. And for some, it was known as the New York Central Train Station. Some sort of offhandedly referred to it as the Bragdon Station or Union Station. It was a beautiful building and highly regarded even today, 100 years later. We found a blog run by architecture and rail aficionados that said this station in Rochester was the seventh most beautiful in the country when it existed, whatever metrics they use. But it wouldn't last. You see, the interstate took some passengers away, and in the 1960s, it started to be raised. But now the station is making a kind of a return, even if virtually. And we want to welcome Professor Joan Saab from the University of Rochester. She's an associate professor of art and art history and of visual and cultural studies, working on a very special project in relation to this. Nice to see you.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Evan.
Well, and let's start by saying we would love to hear from listeners who have either a memory of the station or some kind of connection to it, right?
Yes, absolutely. Because one of the things that makes this project unique is that we're trying to not only recreate the station digitally, but also amass a sort of living archive, or what we'd like to call a vernacular archive. So one of the things that we're hoping to do is incorporate oral histories into the project. And you know, there are people everywhere I go, I meet people who have memories of the project and may even have photographs or, in some cases, tiles. There are a lot of people who went in and did some deep diving as they were tearing it down. And so we've amassed quite an impressive collection of stuff, but we always need more.
Yeah. And so if you want to call the program today and let us know what your memories were of the old station, 263-WXXI, 263-9994 in Rochester, 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, no matter where you are. And it's one thing to talk to somebody who remembers it. It's another to talk to somebody who's got, like, a physical piece of it.
Right. And I've spoken to a couple of people. One gentleman brought his son with him, and they went in the sort of cover of night, and they took all these tiles. And it's great because we have a huge—I mean, the University of Rochester has the Bragdon Archive, and it's vast. It consists of his letters and his writings and architectural drawings and photographs, but they're not in color. And because we want to match the color as best we can, it helps to have some of the actual tiles. And we have a lot of them. But, you know, there's this beautiful fountain, if people, you know, remember the station. There was this absolutely beautiful fountain with a bird and just gorgeous. And I can't tell you how many people say, somebody took the fountain, but nobody knows who.
somebody out there.
Somebody has it. Somebody has it.
And by the way,
tiles.
The statute of limitations has run out. You will not be in any kind
of
trouble.
You'll be a hero.
If you have the, it's not even a negative. It's a positive. If you have that fountain.
Please, please. We also, I should say, we have set up an email address. It's bragdon.ur@gmail.com. So that if you know somebody who knows somebody who's not available to call in today, they can always shoot me an email at
okay.
that address.
Well, let's kind of go back in time a little bit here, too. It opens around 1914, designed in 1913. It lasted only about 50 years. But it was, by everything I read, the descriptions are marvelous. I'm thinking more like Grand Central New York. I mean, it's just a really remarkable description.
It is. I mean, and the thing that you have to understand is when these stations were built, train travel was how people got from coast to coast, from city to city. This predates the advent of the personal automobile and, you know, air travel. So that if someone was taking a West Coast trip, I talked to one woman who has very fond memories. Her father worked for Eastman Kodak, and he went to Los Angeles on a regular basis. And she has very grand memories of the station. She would go, but they're tied to these, like, very personal memories of putting her father on the train and talking to the porters. And one time she hurt her hand and she had to go to Traveler's Aid. And so the types of memories that people associate with the station are really interesting. And the stations reflect that. I mean, if you think about someplace like Grand Central Station in New York, which I have to say, Jackie Kennedy Onassis got involved in that. This station was torn down right at the moment before historic preservation started. They all were this. They were these sort of cathedrals or, you know, secular cathedrals to sort of travel and, you know, adventure.
Does it have something to do with the fact that before the advent of the interstates and travel by car was more common, that travel was more formal. People certainly dressed up to fly. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they dressed up to take the train, but travel was a little bit more formal back then.
Travel was certainly more formal back then, and it often took a long time. So that travel was part of the trip. So that if you were going to, say, Chicago, it might take you a day or two. Or if you're going to Los Angeles, it might take you a week. So you had to incorporate that experience into the entire trip. So it wasn't, you know, today we think like, oh gosh, I've got to get to the airport early. It's going to be delayed. It's such a hassle. But back then, there was a glamour and, it was much more formal. There were porters and, you know.
Yeah. When I travel now, and I've taken Amtrak or whenever I travel really anywhere that I'm not in a car, I think elastic waistband, how comfortable can I get? You know, I mean, it's just a totally different mindset.
Right. And snacks, right?
Yes,
back
exactly
then,
right.
You know, there were dining cars and car cars. And it's hard for us, you know. I'm assuming that you too. I wasn't born when this station was built or tore down. So I have no – it's hard to wrap your head around that.
We're talking to Professor Joan Saab from the University of Rochester. Again, we'd love to hear from you. Call us if you have memories of that station. That Professor Saab, where was the station?
It's where the station is today.
Yeah.
But, you know, because
– Much different building.
Much different building. And our goal is to reconstruct it, but to also add this other layer of sort of historical analysis and – memory to it. So that's, you know, we want to make it a sort of living archive.
Mm-hmm. And I see the phone ringing now. So we'll grab that call in just a second here. Again, it's 263-WXXI, 263-9994, or toll free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Mary Jane and Webster, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, Mary Jane.
Yes, I was a little girl in kindergarten, and my father worked for the New York Central, and he had passes to take us occasionally. And we went to Niagara Falls, and when I got back to the kindergarten, the teacher had me tell the story. And the first thing I said, how frightening it was to be up on the train track, and that engine was going and the smoke was chug, chug, chug. But it was so beautiful in Niagara Falls, and she got out her easel board and took my story down. And for a long time, I had that story wrapped in paper. But he also was, that was the Lake Clear Junction was his stop off. And later in my years, when I had family, we went up to Lake Clear to camp. And when he heard that, it brought back so many memories for us. But the one thing about the station, it was like the movies that were so glamorous during the Depression, that you felt you were, you know, you like you felt you had it when you went to the movies. And when you walked into that station, it was so beautiful, so vast, so large. I was so unhappy to have it go. I've got lots of memories about that. My takeoff for South Carolina when my husband was in the Marines, and it was a big adventure to go, not like when I was a child.
And Mary Jane, let me jump in because we're starting to kind of lose your connection, but what do you think when you hear her memories there, Joan?
Oh, these are exactly, I'm thinking, Mary Jane, I want to talk to you some more. but these are exactly the types of memories that we're interested in. And I think you're absolutely right. And I think connecting them to the movies makes so much sense to me because they're both about the powers of technology to transport you to another place in time. So I can, like when you were talking, I can imagine standing on that platform and, you know, that big cavernous space and hearing the trains coming in and smelling the smoke. I mean, it's such a sort of sensory experience. And thank you so much for sharing it.
Let's grab Bruce in Rochester. Thanks for calling, Bruce. You got to turn your radio down just a little bit, but go ahead.
How are you?
Go ahead. Thanks for calling, Bruce.
Yeah, I'm not as old as she is, but I used that train station as a young boy. I mean, little kid. My mother was from Birmingham, Alabama, and every summer in the 1950s, we would take the train down to Birmingham, which was a 2.5-day excursion. And so I got a lot of experience in the United States on rail travel before I saw good rail in Europe and England and other places. And I still think that the rail travel between Albany and Manhattan is extraordinarily good. There's no city in the world that is successful over a period of time without rail. It's a fact of life that rail travel and rail traffic is a significant part of what makes big cities and big population areas function. And it's a shame, really, that in the United States today, we don't have the quality of service we had in the 1950s. If it weren't for the fact that the rail companies were required to build their own tracks, and the federal government builds all the roads, you wouldn't have any automobiles that could afford to be on the road. The reality is, the way the tax structures in this country, cars are supported because General Motors and Ford got the good deal with Congress in the day, and well, railroads weren't. And you know, if you take these stations that existed, like the Rochester station, they were beautiful. They were very, very attractive. They were beautiful to walk into, and they're that way in Cleveland, they're that way in Manhattan, they're that way in many, many cities in the United States.
Well, Bruce, let me jump in and say we had a Rochester has a transportation expert on staff who handles certain transportation issues, and he believes that the future of transportation in urban settings is becoming more multimodal again. It sort of became car-dominated for decades, and now it's becoming a little bit more mixed. But regardless of where we go in the future with that, I know that it's I think it's important to ask Professor Saab why exactly you wanted to do this. I'm sensing that essentially it's just making sure history is not lost. But give me your reasoning for wanting to do this project.
Well, there are many reasons I want to do this project. I'm trained as a cultural historian, and I've become very interested in using new technologies to enhance our understanding of the past so that the technologies aren't just another illustration, but they in somehow or another bring ideas together in new and interesting ways. So even, you know, listening to the decline of train travel, that's another part of this story. And so if you can do, I mean, you said multimodal, this is how scholars of sort of digital culture talk. It'll be a sort of multimodal history. So there are different ways from this station that you can go in different directions. But I also, as somebody who teaches architectural history, it's a lost building, and I'm interested in sort of rebuilding it virtually so that people can experience it, because it's very difficult to teach architectural history with slides, and it's even more difficult to go places. You know, Rochester has a wealth of really great architectural examples, and so whenever I can, I get my kids out of the classroom and into the spaces. But you can't always do that. So these digital structures are one way so that people can experience the space, because this is, in my mind, the best way to understand architecture is through all of your senses.
Yeah, you move beyond sort of foggy black and white sketches and photos to a 3D color recreation.
And we'll never do it perfectly.
Sure.
But my interest in this project goes even beyond that, so that the story is encapsulated, or the many, many stories, just some of the stories that we're hearing today, are encapsulated within the experience of walking through it. So we're going to have ways that you can click on certain things and hear people talk about their experiences, or read about why train travel declined in, you know, the 1950s and 60s in the United States. So it's going to be this holistic kind of experience.
Richard in Rochester, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, Richard.
Well, thank you. And I'm addressing this to the professor, but wasn't the old train station a Claude Bragdon structure? It was very famous in that it had no beams, no supporting beams within the grand hall, if you will.
Yes.
Waiting station.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons why we're so interested in this, is because of the Gustavino vaults. You know, it's an architectural wonder. And another, you know, Bragdon is quite well known in Rochester, and there are Bragdon aficionados all over the world. But I think Bragdon is fascinating for many, many reasons. And one of my goals and my partner, Joni Rubin, on this project is to reintroduce Bragdon to a broader architectural narrative so that he gets his due. You know, he's been sort of eclipsed by Wright and Sullivan in many circles. And so this is also, in some ways, a historiographic project as well. So, yes, it's an amazing, amazing structure. It was an amazing structure. You know, colleagues of mine in engineering talk about the vaulting, and that's another part of this project.
Well, are you going to try to recreate? My father worked for the railroad and worked at that location for 48 years, so I'm very familiar with it. I've even called a cousin of mine who worked at the station with his dad from time to time.
Oh, I'd love to talk to both of you.
And I've asked
him
to call you because he has one of the remaining, well, he actually doesn't have it, but his grandson has one of the remaining Rochester Station signs, the heavy.
Oh, fantastic.
Signs, and it's in Chicago at this point. He'll be calling you hopefully soon.
I could also give you all my phone number that people who can't. Yeah, my work number is 275-4287.
That's a 585.
Right? So 275-4287. And if I'm not there, you can just leave a message. It's got a long voicemail message box.
No, I will. One last question. Now, I'm glad to hear that you're going to try to recreate digitally the large open space, which was magnificent. But what about the subway space? Because you went down in order to go up to the tracks.
Right.
You're going to try to recreate that. That was a marvel in and of itself.
Well, we're working with a really, again, this is a hugely collaborative project because the two scholars on the project are not trained in, you know, software design. So we have a group of technologists who are actually using Autodesk Revit and Maya, which is an architectural software, but also a game making software, so that we will hopefully be able to travel through the spaces that connect with it and have that sort of experience of moving through the space, almost like you would if you're in, you know, I'm not a gamer, but I've seen my kids play, almost like you would in some of those.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you, and I appreciate being on the program today. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for the call, Richard. Yeah, thank you very much for the call. Those are the moments where I know you're saying in the progress that you're making and understanding, you can't have enough of those kind of conversations, can you?
No, not enough. And so, as I said, I'm loving hearing these. And each time somebody calls in, you know, if you could see my face, it lights up. So I do hope that I'll be able to talk to everybody who's called in today in more detail. So either drop me an email at bragdon.ur@gmail.com or call me at 275-4287, area code 585. I'd really appreciate it.
All of these shows are podcasted on our connections page, wxxinews.org/connections. So if you're hearing this sort of in a car somewhere, or you want someone else to hear it, you'll be able to do that later today. We're talking to Professor Joan Saab from the University of Rochester about this project to recreate the old station, the New York Central train station. And if you're just sort of hearing it in bits and pieces, or maybe you're my age or even Joan's age and you never got to see the thing in person, we've talked about Bragdon and Richard made the point there, but kind of set the scene a little for me, Joan. Take me inside the station that people have a hard time believing was actually right here in Rochester.
Well, my experience of the station right now is through the memories that we're hearing now and black and white photographs and architectural drawings. So really 2D and personal memories. But if you look at photographs of the station, it does look like many turn-of-the-century stations with these giant vaulted ceilings. But the thing that for me is really interesting about this station is the color of the tiles and the way that they sort of interacted with the space. Bragdon was a theosophist, and he was very interested in the relationship between color and movement and bodies and space. And so this, one of the things that we're hoping to do is to take some of his theories and animate them through it in ways that you can't do by looking at a photograph. So it was, as people have described today, it was a very my understanding of it is it was a very grand space with mosaic tiles and vaulted ceilings, and then a central area full of benches that many people have talked about the benches to me as well. And between the wars, there were a lot of military people who were there who would hang out on the benches, not as derelicts or as sort of indigents as we may think of, like people hanging out in train stations, but as places where they would actually go and meet with one another or be in transit and meet with one another. So it was a real place of connection.
If you still have a little more time, if you want to jump in and share your memories of it, 263-WXXI, 263-9994 if you're in Rochester or no matter where you are, toll free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. There is no way, if that structure existed today, even if the use changed, even if it fell out of favor with the transportation methods of the time, there's no way it would be destroyed.
No way. And even 5 years later, I don't think so. It was torn down in increments, though. It wasn't like they came in 1965 and just bulldozed the place.
But why at all?
I think today there's a much more keen awareness of the importance of the past. And so we're looking at a moment where, you know, it's old, we don't need it. Things were sort of thrown out. And there's all sorts of historical reasons. It's a moment where people are leaving the city in droves for the suburbs. There's riots taking place, Rochester being one of the cities that had a number of race riots. And so people are leaving the city. And there was an idea about what was valuable and what was worth saving. But I think you're absolutely right. Today it would be probably a vibrant space, you know, with restaurants, maybe condominiums. I don't know. If you look at other cities, I know that Buffalo is working on restoring their station. Union Station in D.C. has a number of restaurants and shops in it. And Grand Central is a great example of a station that's actually still being used.
Yeah. So here we are with this project happening now. And I see the phones lighting up again. Wow. Three lines lighting up all at once here. Poor Dave behind the glass is getting buried back there. We're going to get to your calls. What's the timeline for you? What do you hope is coming for this project?
Well, like any project, when we first started it, we thought, oh, it'll be simple. But it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but in very good ways. And so we have a sort of 3D renderings of some of the spaces and light fixtures and things like that. And we're starting to amass an interesting collection of oral histories. So it's just putting the pieces together. But it's also one of the things that I'm loving in talking to people is the richness of their memories and what sorts of stories those open up. And for cultural historians, these are nuggets of gold.
Yeah.
So we're hoping, you know, I'm going to have my class get involved with this, and we're hoping that it will be in place within the next year. We got money from the university. We're applying for some other national grants. But then once it's up and running, it will be able to be added to. So it won't ever, in theory, be finished. It will be, as I said, this sort of living document.
Yeah, absolutely. Mary in Rochester. Thanks for calling, Mary. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I remember the old station. I was very young, very small, about six probably, five or six. And I remember the benches and how hard they were. But Claude Bragdon was a friend of my grandparents. So I have memorabilia around it, but I have to, I've been waiting to find a spot to take it to because I don't know what to do with it. Every time he published a book, he would sign it to my grandparents with a squiggle that went all the way down the page. Did he sign anybody else's books that way?
I'm not sure. I'll have to. I'm sure if my rare books librarian is listening to this right now, she's probably, you know, hopping up and down.
Yeah.
So if you'd like to come in and take a look at some of his other papers, you know, I'm sure we could arrange something
and show
like
Professor Saab what you have.
Yeah, yeah, no, that would be great. But if she wants to see other signed books, we could arrange that.
Well, the only other thing I wanted to mention was that, you know, when people got off the train from New York, they would often walk home from the station, and the story goes that the first president of the Republic of Ireland, Eamon de Valera, got off the train from New York in Rochester and walked to his mother's house, which was on South Goodman. And on the way, he passed my grandparents' house. And there was always a big flurry of noise and footsteps running to the window to see Eamon de Valera.
Oh, what an amazing story.
Mary,
father told me.
Mary, thanks for calling. And if you want to hook up with Professor Saab, how does she do that, Professor?
Oh, there's lots of ways. Probably giving me a call would be the easiest.
Do the number again.
585-275-4287. But we also have an email address, bragdon.uvar@gmail.com.
Thank you very much for the call, Mary. Let's try to grab another couple quick calls on this subject. I think we have Hal in Sparta. Go ahead, Hal.
Yes. Yesterday, after 20 years of living in the area, we visited the summer home of Frederick Ferris Thompson, who was a prominent banker in New York City. That was what we know as the Sonnenberg Gardens.
Mm.
And it came to my attention that they apparently had a New York Central line to Canandaigua, and I've previously visited the estate of the Vandervolts, who owned the New York Central and had their own private station and car on the Hudson River in Hyde Park. And, of course, other prominent individuals, including George Eastman, lived in the late 19th and early 20th century in Rochester. So it occurred to me that the kind of original 1% at that time often had private cars and private arrangements and went between these stations. So perhaps one historic view would be to see how these extraordinarily wealthy people at the time got about, since much of, if you read James Howard's Kunstler, The Geography of Nowhere, which is a history of suburbanization of Long Island, the very first people were the wealthiest mm-hmm. people who had train cars, and then eventually there were roads. So I wonder if you have anything to say about the history of Rochester in terms of the most wealthy.
We have some great photographs of George Eastman getting onto his, private car. So, yes, you're absolutely right. This is another part of the story that needs to be told. And it's the station, for a space that's a sort of transit space, a sort of liminal space, for many people, not this particular station, but spaces of transit as sort of throwaway spaces, it contains so many different histories and ways of looking at history that this is an important one to keep in mind as well. And it's one that we're looking into. So thank you for bringing up the connections.
Yeah, thank you, Hal. One more call on the subject. Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, I wasn't here when the train station was kind of alive, shall we say. But just a couple things. I'm sure you're familiar with, I think it's Utica, that has they redid their train station. Mm-hmm. I think it's Utica, it's either Rome or Utica. And it took them years. And that place, what was great about it, they had some of the old foundation stuff still, the shell. So they redid the inside and they kept the outside, looking kind of like it normally would if it was that old, and which is a great look. That's just a comment. The other thing is, though, that I wonder, the Cumberland Building where the post office is, right in that area. I wonder, it just to me always a shame that building is not getting its just desserts in terms of being really used, and it's a beautiful building. And it's probably privately owned and all that, but I wonder if there's any thought about how to, connect that to the train station, if not literally, but in some other way. So thank you.
Thanks,
yeah,
buddy.
We're trying to do a sort of multi-layered map of the different buildings that were around at the time and that are still here or that are no longer here. And that's certainly on our radar. It might be a topic for another show. But it's, certainly an important topic, the reuse of historic buildings.
And one more call, because they keep coming in. Professor Saab, look what you've done.
Look what we've done.
Glenn in Rochester. Thanks, Glenn. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. Thank you. I'm just curious about the different archives that you've been using to collect your images from. I know that my great-great-grandfather was the first photojournalist in Rochester, Albert Stone, and he took some amazing images of the vaulted ceilings, and I remember, I'm not sure of the dates, but I remember them not being shown with any people inside, so I don't know if it was before the opening or, but I think that they would be great images for you to go through if you haven't already.
We have gone through those, and they're amazing, and we've looked at, you know, we're trying to be creative because there are a lot of official archives. What we want are the pictures of people, you know, dropping off their, you know, father, or they're picking up their grandmother. So, yes, I've seen the stone images, and they've been invaluable for us as we try to reconstruct what the inside of the space would have looked like.
Excellent.
So,
okay,
thank you.
Thanks, Glenn. Thanks for calling. Great stuff on this subject. And if our listeners want to follow this project again, Professor Saab, how would you have them do that?
Please, please contact me at 585-275-4287 or bragdon.ur@gmail.com.
And online, where can they start to see it coming together?
Well, once it's live, right now we're still really beta, then we'll have a website and I'll make sure that people...
Well, you come back here and we'll talk about it.
Absolutely.
Because you can see the interest in history here. This is a structure that was designed 101 years ago, built 100 years ago, and it was raised beginning just about 50 years ago. There's no way it would ever have been raised like that today, but Professor Saab's work at the University of Rochester with her colleague,
Joan Rubin,
is helping preserve that in a 3D way, more than just the black and white. So it'll be very interesting to follow that and to follow the way they're trying to preserve Claude Bragdon's work and the architectural marvel that was Rochester's New York Central train station. Short break, and we're fortunate to have Professor Saab here because she happens to be a professor of art and art history, cultural studies. And when we come back, our friend Tom Proietti joins us. We're going to be talking about the loss of Anne B. Davis this week and whether there are any more modern-day Alices. Are there still people in sitcoms, on the screen, that America loves the same way? Have we lost that? We're going to explore that next on member-supported public radio. On the next Connections, it's Arts Friday. If you have ever wanted to paint, we meet the artists who overcame their doubts to build successful careers. We'll go to Finger Lakes Wine Country, which is building its support of the regional art scene. We'll visit the Smith Opera House in Geneva, which finally has air conditioning and a full summer series. And we'll go to Perry, where they're getting ready for the big Chalk Arts Festival. It's a packed Arts Friday on Connections.
Do you know an unwanted car or truck makes a perfect gift? It does when you donate it to WXXI's vehicle donation program. Your contribution will go directly towards supporting the radio and television programs you turn to each day. Your vehicle may have little or no trade-in value, but it could be priceless to WXXI. Learn more about WXXI's vehicle donation program at wxxi.org/car.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we continue just for a few minutes with Professor Joan Saab, she's going to run out of here in just a second, but I got to at least ask her a couple questions about the cultural questions that are coming. And Tom Proietti's here. He's a media scholar in residence at St. John Fisher College, and of course, a longtime friend and visitor of this program. Tom, great to see you, my friend.
Great to be here, Evan. Thanks.
And
what a great show, by the way.
I hate to interrupt. you were hooked already on the subject.
I'm a train freak, and I love that train station. It was so beautiful. It was a place that I was just telling you, Professor, about this. When I was a kid, this was where the important family members came in from Cleveland and from Long Island and Staten Island. And you mentioned something earlier about people dressing up. You always dressed up. I mean, you just did. You dressed up to go on a train. You dressed up to go on an airplane. It was just really important to do.
Yeah, there was a pageantry to travel that has been somewhat...
Now it's sweatpants.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And I'm guilty as...
If you're lucky.
I am guilty as anybody. I wanted our guest now to talk about Anne B. Davis, who died... any death is tragic. And you say, well, she was 88. By all accounts, she was a remarkably healthy 88-year-old. She died after a fall earlier this
Subdermal
week.
Subdermal hematoma. She took a plop, and I mean, that could kill a 5-year-old.
Yeah,
so.
It's just really,
very
really
sad.
Very sad. And she played Alice, of course, from 1969 to 1974 on The Brady Bunch. I've got a couple clips. It just occurred to me that I have clips, and I think our engineer knows this. My brain has been in 1,000 directions today.
David's a magician anyways.
The first Alice clip is Alice talking to Marcia and Greg, and Alice trying to sound cool the way the kids did. You're going to hear Marcia's voice first.
Do you know what happened to Warren and Kathy?
Well, like you kids say, they split.
They must have been pretty mad at us.
No, they didn't look mad. In fact, they looked kind of chummy.
What do you mean, chummy?
Well, he said, hey, how'd you like to go to the pizza parlor? And she said, far out. And she said, how about taking me to the carnival Friday night? And he said, far out. He said, so long. And I said, far out. Didn't want him to think I wasn't on it.
With it.
With it.
How about that?
I'm really glad for him.
Me too. But we still have to apologize. Let's go down to the pizza parlor.
Far out.
So there's Ann B. Davis's Alice there. And, you know, I grew up watching the reruns of that show and just loved it.
Sure.
Huh?
And one of the most interesting stories I have to tell is we had four French exchange students, and I also had many foreign students while I was teaching at MCC. And one of the constants that I heard over and over again, I also had a student in 1988 who spent the summer in Rochester's sister city in Russia, Novgorod. And the only thing they all had in common, they could sing the theme to the Brady Bunch. And they all knew the name. They knew the names of everyone. And Alice was always their favorite, too. Alice and Jan, who was the middle child. And if you ever watch it really closely, for a relationship kind of thing, Alice was always protecting Jan. She was Jan. And I'm a middle child, so I understand that completely. We need that kind of protection because we're a mess.
Well, Professor Saab's going to have to get out of here in a second, but let me at least ask you. America, her passing was very sad for a lot of people. It stirred up the memories of the show, and the show lives on. Are there modern-day Alices, or am I being too cynical? Maybe there are. I don't know.
I don't know. I think our relationship to television has changed so much, and that television has changed so that we don't have the same relationship to characters as we did back then. Although I think there are people who watch some network TV and do develop these relationships. I just don't see it in my friends or children to the same extent that, as you were talking about, we all did with the Brady Bunch.
Yeah, well, something happened. If you notice, the series ended in 1974. It had a great life in what we call the evergreen world of syndication. But by 1974, Norman Lear had really changed the nature of television. Norman Lear brought us All in the Family and the Jeffersons and Maude, and he changed everything about the nature of television. The Brady Bunch was one of the last really super successful shows that kind of alluded to an America that never really existed. It was totally white, completely white. It was the traditional American family in the worst possible way from the 1950s with, the idiot father and the mother who dressed in high heels walking around the house, and then happened to have this white servant working in the house who happened to be the most real human being on the program. She was truly the mother, the father, but she was also the conscience and she was the soul. And
that's why we loved her.
I think we all wished we had an Alice in our house, because our parents were busy.
Not to clean the house, just to kind of talk to the kids. The kids on the show loved Alice, right?
And Alice had a life of her own, right? She had Sam. So it wasn't that she was just taking care of them. She was a fully sort of realized and to the extent that
it was never a consummated Sam. Alice was always, I think about some friend of mine was telling me about Alice in Chains yesterday, and I said, I'm talking about Alice tomorrow, Alice in Reigns. I mean, that's really, if Norman Lear, and I was also thinking, if SNL can do a bit on Alice, if Alice was being portrayed today in let's say by the people who do The Big Bang Theory, think of what Alice would be. I mean, she'd be a bouncer. She'd be a lesbian bouncer for one thing. For sure. I mean, absolutely. Ann B. Davis never married in her lifetime, and the rumors flew around Hollywood. She didn't pay much attention to it. But at that time, that was not an acceptable thing to talk about until Norman Lear brought it up. Then other sitcoms along the way. Just think about what Seinfeld did to relationships. When the Seinfeld series ended, I was sad that the series ended, but I didn't give a crap about any of the characters. They were the most shallow, amoral creatures
Seinfeld,
on the planet.
Friends, they're all ensembles.
Yeah, they're ensembles, and they're not really people you care about. They're people you can laugh at. Like Big Bang Theory is one of my favorites right now, so is Modern Family. There's nobody there I have an emotional attachment
to. Yeah, see, that's the interesting
thing. When MASH ended, the country cried.
Yeah.
Yeah, when the Brady Bunch ended, the country cried. Well, a lot of that also was a reflection of a fewer number of channels and this communal experience of 80 million, you know, 80 million people watched the Brady Bunch in its heyday.
And then in syndication, every day after school, I remember watching it.
But that, you know, that's done in a completely different way. When you watch it in syndication, you're watching it off time, off peak. You're watching it on your own. It's not a familial, communal situation. It's highly escapist in nature, whereas if you put it on in primetime and you're there with mom and dad watching it as a family, it becomes religious in nature.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to play another clip if we could. And this is a clip that, you know, as much as Professor Saab brought up the fact that Alice had Sam, we certainly didn't think of Alice in a very sexual way, of course. And yet here's a scene where the kids, the two young kids, Cindy and Bobby, are going door to door trying to convince people to sign a petition to save the local park. And they find a gruff gentleman who does not want to sign the petition. And Alice notices that the kids were bothered by this gruff gentleman that wouldn't sign their petition. So Alice decides she's going to go throw some game at him because she knows how to get him to sign the petition. This is from the Brady Bunch.
Hi there. Is the lady of the house at home?
Well, there ain't no lady of the house.
You mean a big, strong, handsome man like you isn't married?
Maybe it's that I just ain't met Mrs. Wright yet.
Well, if you were married, if you had kids, I can tell that you're the kind of sensitive, intelligent guy that would want them to have a safe place to play, right?
You sure got me pegged, sister. Say, I don't see no ring on that finger either.
No. They just called me Alice Available.
Alice Available.
Ooh, about as sexy as a salmon.
Yeah. She's not all that sexy, but she played it up for that scene.
She did and she didn't. I mean, now in retrospect, now that I look at it, you know, as a father of a gay daughter and somebody who watched the gay revolution, you know, take place and amongst my students, I realize, you know, this was part of the repression that we kind of went through. And in retrospect, I see it completely differently as I did that, you know, as completely differently than as I did when it was happening, because I wanted Alice to be happy. But I always had this burning fear that Alice was going to get married and leave. And I thought the family would fall apart, and I'm pretty sure they would have fallen apart. I mean, she was the glue. She was the fabric that held the family together.
Well, it didn't occur to me. I get lost in these conversations with our guests, but if you do want to join the program, we'd love to hear from you, 263-WXXI, or toll-free, 844-295-TALK. And we've got Tom in Rochester. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes. Can you hear me all right?
I can.
Yeah, okay, good. Thank you. I saw very little of the Brady Bunch, but I remember another show previously in the 1950s. The first time I saw Andy Davis,
the Bob Cummings show.
Robert Cummings show,
right?
It was on Saturday night, and he played a photographer, and she was his secretary, and she won an Emmy for that role.
She sure did.
Was her name on the show?
Schultze, right? And she was the only female never attracted to Bob.
She was always sort of running after him, and she was Andy Davis was on a show. She was being interviewed on a show with Pamela Mason, who at the time was married to James Mason, and it was about pursuing relationships or something, or, you know, how women go after men or something like this. And then she said, and then Pamela Mason's, and then Andy Davis said, you know, I chased Robert Cummings up and down, you know, all through the office, up and down the, up the walls and over the down the ceiling, you know, for years, but never, never caught him, you know. And so I guess in the television show that was sort of disappointing to her character, but then Pamela Mason said, well, the fun's in the chase. And then Andy Davis said, "Well, you do it your way, dear, and I'll do it." Anyway, she did win the Emmy for that.
She won two Emmys in her career, actually.
Learned that when I was listening to her on that program, that interview program, but she, yeah, so that's the first time I saw her, and I was wondering if anybody remembers her from that show.
Schulze, I remember her very well, very well, and I remember her quite differently. She was kind of she protected Bob the photographer because all the hotties were after him. He used to photograph a lot of women in modeling and fashion shoots, and she was the one who kind of got in the way and apparently was a little bit jealous when some of the females would be successful with Bob. But that was one of the early shows that ever alluded to any sexual possibility.
But you're implying that Ann B. Davis, if she were gay, and again, we don't know, there was some suspicion.
Right.
If she were gay, she had to go throughout her career essentially playing roles that were less sexualized because that was the way to get work at the time. The way to get work at the time was not to be out because then you get marginalized.
Right. Well, notice in the Brady Bunch, she was always in uniform. And that's, the only time she was out of uniform was when the kids cast her in the Pilgrim play, they were putting her in or had her skiing on the side of a mountain in the backyard.
Let's grab Craig in Pittsburgh. Go ahead, Craig.
Yeah, hi. I was calling because I actually happened to have worked in Los Angeles for about 10 years and got to know Flo Henderson Kappus and Barry Williams a little bit. And at
Fantastic.
Some point it came up in conversation about Ann B. Davis and Barry Hart says, "Oh, Annie." And apparently, this from the few stories he told, she parented a bit on set, too, and was funny and very well-loved. And Flo had absolutely nothing but just wonderful things to say about her and working out there. And just thought I'd share that with you.
I'm glad you brought that up because you probably know the work that she did with vets and the work she did early on with the Presbyterian Church later in her life.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I know when she retired, she got back into church work and was doing, basically mission type things.
And she was actually living with a minister and his wife.
When she died.
Yeah. She took a tumble in their house. And she was a marvelous human being. There was the only, she said, I remember once hearing her say the only flawed side of her was she had a passion for Porsches. So she liked kids more than she liked Porsches. And she had a collection, I think about 5 Porsches at one point.
Craig, that's a great
story.
It is a great story. And thank you for calling and sharing that. And, Craig's story leads me to think, Tom, too, that we loved Ann B. Davis, and her death is so tragic to so many people because she was loved on the show that she was most famous in, but she was also respected by her colleagues. And as much as we now live in the TMZ world where there isn't much privacy and there was more privacy back then, she was still beloved by fans in a way that was very genuine.
Yeah, and the thing that I see missing, though, is, I've asked a couple of young people today, do you remember? I just asked my nephew Christopher, who's 20 years old. He said, "What are you talking about on the radio today, Uncle Tom?" And I said, Alice from the Brady Bunch. He goes, "Oh, I never experienced that." And I said, "I think you're going to have to go back and do that." And he said, "I just wish I had time." But he sees in his parents, who are old enough to remember that, there was a heart tear. And he said, "Mom and Dad both stopped in their tracks on Sunday when they heard that she had died." And I said, she was a really important character in American television, and therefore part of this huge American mosaic that makes up our character as people.
You've been interacting with people online, talking to them about it. And if you see Tom
some
online,
great,
Tom
great
again, always
comments.
Gets such great comments. What's some of the commentary you've heard?
A lot of it is just pure love and affection this great, great person as a person. But most of them referred to her as Alice. They didn't talk about Ann B. Davis. Mm-hmm. And they talk about her as Alice, as if she was this real human being. And they talk about her in very warm terms. Only one person made somewhat disparaging comment about the program, not about her either. And they talked about how she had to become the substitute parent because the two real parents, were not that good as parents. And they really were not. I mean, they were kind of absentee parents. And I've heard Florence Henderson talk about that and say, well, that was part of the setup of the show. Florence Henderson is probably a great parent on her own.
Yeah.
But when you're in the world of acting and you run onto a successful formula, you have to do what you have to do. And, it was really important for her to fill that role. So the comment, as of this morning, there were 36 comments that people had put out, or 36 different people who had made comments about Ann B. about the Alice character.
About Alice,
and just just so touching. And you know, I even put a comment on there. I said, you people are so sweet.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that reflects her as well.
Well, and we got a couple minutes left with Tom Proietti, our guest, the media scholar in residence at St. John Fisher College, and talking about the loss of Ann B. Davis, but then in modern ways. Now, Friends went off the air 10 years ago,
right.
So that's not
that's
even
an
modern
old
anymore.
Show. Yeah.
But even with Friends, which is one of the most highly rated shows, Seinfeld, when those actors pass away, when Jerry Seinfeld dies in the future, it will be a sad day for a lot of people.
Yes,
they'll remember
will.
His show.
Yep.
They respect him as for his work. But I don't know if there's anybody. I'm trying to think if there's an Alice-like character in modern American television, and I just don't know.
No, and ever since you and I talked about this the other day, I've been racking my brain trying to think of one character that I would care about. And the only thing I could come close to are characters from – not from sitcoms. They're from dramas. They're people, you know, like the folks from The Good Wife and maybe folks from Grey's Anatomy. But even then, it's not going to be the same kind of passionate, intimate –
because you don't have the viewership.
Well, the viewership is different. And that's – you know, one of the keys to the most watched ending of a series ever was MASH. And those were people – when that series ended – we cried. I mean, we literally cried because there has never been a medium that has allowed for character development like as television has done. And in the process of that character development, allowing us to build a relationship with a character that is so powerful, deep, and profound that it's almost familial in nature.
The MASH ending was
1984.
Yeah. That was really the
one of the greatest shows ever.
But that was the end of sort of an era.
Yeah.
Not just for the show.
Right.
But, you know, you were 10 years past the Brady Bunch. MASH
right.
is over.
Right.
Then you were getting into the Cheerses of the world and shows that people loved and people may have loved some of the characters, but not quite to the same way. And ever since then, it's been a little bit of a change.
Because it's been less communal.
You yeah.
know, I was part of the cable TV revolution. I was part of the group that launched cable in Rochester, for example. And we went from 4 channels to 12 channels. And then within 3 months, we were at 20 channels. And a year later, we were at 28 channels. And, you know, 18 months after that, we were at 56 channels. And once you start diffusing the audience that way, you stop, you know, it just diminishes the American experience. You know, you know what happened with TV Nightly News. There used to be 60 million viewers a night. Today, there's 20 million viewers a night.
And you take the good with the bad with that, I guess. But
yeah, exactly.
But part of the result is that we don't really see the modern-day Alices anymore.
No, and we see community in sports for the most part.
Yeah, it's a great point. But you know what? We've got her in syndication still. We've got her in reruns
forever.
Still.
She's
always have
what we call an evergreen.
There you go. Tom Proietti, it's always great to talk
to
you, my friend.
Really my pleasure.
And Tom Proietti joining us. And thanks to you for listening on this Thursday afternoon. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks to Dave Campo, our engineer. Arts Friday tomorrow. I'll see you right back here on Member-Supported Public Radio.